The new tax law is already changing the way business gets done. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, December 29th. Good to have you with us. 2017 has been a good year for jobs. On average, employers added 170,000 jobs a month. The unemployment rate is at a 17-year low, 4.1%, which puts the economy at or pretty close to what's considered full employment. In most places, it's easy to find a job and hard to find workers to hire if you're an employer. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains what that means for wages, inflation, and the incoming Fed chair.
Over the past year, unemployment's fallen by 0.5% to just above 4%. According to Orthodox Economics, that means we're hovering around full employment now. Basically, the model says if unemployment falls lower, employers will be so desperate for workers they'll have to jack up wages rapidly to get them and raise their prices to pay for it, and inflation will rise out of control. But, says market strategist Brian Railing at Wells Fargo,
wages have held fairly stagnant. We haven't really seen that pop that you would expect when unemployment is at such low levels.
And that means we're probably not at full employment, at least not yet, says economist Michael Strain at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute.
There are still a lot of people not officially in the labor market because they've given up searching for work, but employers think they might come back. Those individuals are holding down wage growth.
Labor economist Jesse Rothstein at UC Berkeley says employers still have a fair amount of leverage over workers to keep wages in check.
You're continually hearing stories of employers who say there's a real problem, there are labor shortages, and you ask them, have you tried offering a higher wage? And they haven't.
Average hourly earnings increased 2.5% in the past year. That's an improvement from 5 years ago when annual raises were below 2%. But wages still aren't growing much faster than consumer prices. And Brian Railing says for the Fed, that means inflation.
It is a potential risk, of course, something to watch for.
Railing says markets currently expect the Fed under incoming chair Jerome Powell to raise interest rates 3 times next year. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Now for more on what's in store for the new Fed chair and what the tax bill is going to mean to companies and the economy, we have our weekly wrap, a look at the week that was and what's ahead. Joining us today, we have Lynette Lopez from Business Insider and Sudeep Reddy from Politico. Hi, guys. Thanks for being here.
Hey there.
Hi, how's it going?
I want to start with the news that companies like Goldman Sachs and Citigroup are taking these big earnings hits related to the new tax bill. Goldman's case, $5 billion, Citigroup more than that. Sudeep, can you start us off by just explaining what's going on, what these big numbers represent?
These big numbers are all tied to, for the most part, tied to the money these companies had overseas. That's a big part of what this tax bill is going to do for companies. It's going to remove some of the incentive to keep money parked overseas, and it's going to subject that money to a tax. So you're seeing not just banks, but a lot of other companies recognize this tax and start to book it in their earnings reports, and you're going to see that throughout the early stages of 2018 as well, over and over and over. Now, banks are going to be just fine. They're doing quite well. They're going to see lower tax rates as a result. Most companies are going to see lower tax rates. So the offset will be clear before too long for them. But this is just one of the very, very early stages of what we're going to see of this giant tax bill reshaping the economy step by step, trying to change behavior, change incentives, and do something that's contrary to a lot of the principles that they've held in the past.
All right, Lynette, what is that bigger picture here that we're at the very beginning of? Especially, let's start with for companies. What's the big picture here for them of this tax bill?
The question is whether or not this will actually incentivize companies to bring, so to speak, bring money back to the United States and invest money in the United States rather than raising money off debt markets here, using that to power their businesses in the United States and also keeping money abroad. There is debate between economists on whether or not this tax bill goes far enough. What we do know is that with the money that they will repatriate from abroad, they can do in a wide array of things. You know, if you listen to the Trump administration, they'll tell you that companies will reinvest that and actually create wage growth and give people jobs and all that stuff. But what we've learned from the past, like when George W. Bush did this whole tax repatriation situation is that for the most part, companies use this to buy back stock and, you know, other internal things that benefit the company, like compensated executives, things that we don't really see in the economy. And quite frankly, most economists you talk to, whether it's Goldman Sachs itself or Paul Krugman, is kind of meh about what this tax bill will do for the economy. You know, the stock market has been pricing it in for months. That's why we've seen this amazing rally in 2017. And so the question is, how long will that last? Will companies like Goldman Sachs take a temporary hiccup before, you know, settling into the new regime? But overall, it doesn't seem like it's going to be earth-shattering yet.
So a big meh from Lynette. What about you, Sudeep? What do you think the impact might be on the economy?
You know, President Trump signed this thing a week ago, and we're already seeing these effects, not just from these big banks and big corporations, but this week, homeowners across the country in high-tax states have been scrambling to figure out whether they can try to get a tax break by paying their 2018 property taxes. Yeah, well, it's just crazy. It's like who expected that during a holiday week? And so all of that is just in the first week. In the first week, we're starting to see these effects. And so the reason tax legislation is so important, tax policy is so important, is because it changes behavior and changes a lot of the underlying factors driving the economy. So we're definitely going to see significant changes in 2018. We don't yet know whether more of them are going to be on balance better than worse, but that's what we're going to have to watch for, is how much and how quickly this ripples through the economy.
Where are you guys going to be watching?
I'm going to be watching the political situation here, because like this bill will be challenged, you know, as we've been saying, this is an attempt to change behavior, and the changes that people don't like, they're going to fight. Guys like, you know, Governor Andrew Cuomo from New York is trying to figure out how to fight the bill in terms of, you know, what it does to his constituency. Now we know that people in high tax states like California, New York, New Jersey aren't going to be able to deduct their state and local taxes up to after $10,000. And that is a huge issue for some of these states. So expect to see this to become a point where, you know, politicians who want to make their name and get out there for whether it's 2018 or 2020 or whatever, they're going to stake their reputations on this. And so this will be a flashpoint for political arguments for the next whatever.
All right. Well, thank you guys so much. Happy New Year. We've got Lynette Lopez from Business Insider and Sudeep Reddy from Politico.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
The markets today, not pleased. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Cotton farmers in the U.S. have had a rough couple of years. Cotton prices have slumped for a number of reasons, from weather to global trade to yoga pants. James Morrison explains.
Once confined to gyms and Pilates studios, yoga pants are now widely accepted attire in many social settings, from the office to the classroom. Someone has even coined a new term for athletic wear that can be worn by anyone, anywhere. It's called athleisure wear, and University of Nevada, Las Vegas fashion historian Deirdre Clemente says it's here to stay.
We're seeing athleisure wear infiltrate the American wardrobe, and I think that that infiltration has only just begun.
This rise in athletic apparel is bad news for the cotton industry. That's because most of it is made out of synthetic fibers like lycra, polyester, and spandex. Clemente says in the 70-plus year rivalry between natural and synthetic fibers, cotton has always struggled when it comes to sportswear.
There weren't yoga pants before there were synthetic fibers. Why? Because you couldn't get cotton to hold your butt in like that.
But the company in charge of keeping cotton innovative knows exactly how lucrative the activewear market is right now. Mary Ankeny is the vice president of product development at Cotton Incorporated, a North Carolina-based organization that designs and markets new cotton products. She says the company has designed new cotton fabrics that breathe and wick moisture like their synthetic competitors.
We're making a more performance fabric that's intended to be out there to be able to compete with those synthetic options that are on the market.
But cotton has bigger problems than athleisure wear. For instance, China. It's by far the world's largest cotton-producing country, followed by India and the United States. And China heavily regulates its cotton industry. Texas A&M ag economist John Robinson says China bought half the world's cotton supply in 2011 when prices were at a peak of $2 a pound. And then it held that cotton off the market in a government reserve for 3 years.
And so it kind of created an artificial shortage, which maintained high prices for all of 11, 12, and 13, maintained prices higher than they would have been had those bales been in circulation.
But in 2014, China began dumping that reserve, depressing prices, and killing the export market for American cotton growers. And this was happening as U.S. cotton growers were facing problems at home as well. David Dunlow is a cotton grower in North Carolina.
Back in 2015, I think it was 17 days where we had rain and clouds and misty rain, and the temperatures were warm enough for the seed that actually sprouted in the Lent.
That ruined the quality of the crop, and farmers like Dunlow were forced to sell their cotton at half market price. That was a devastating blow, since just a year earlier, in 2014, Congress took cotton out of Title I of the Farm Bill. Title I is a guarantee the government will pay farmers if they suffer a crop failure or a major drop in prices.
30 years I've been farming, I'd say the last 2 or 3 years was really doubting whether this is what I needed to do, you know, be a, quote, cotton farmer. It's been that bad because of weather and because of the safety net not being there and prices being depressed.
But things are looking up. Dunlow says this year's harvest should be better than average, and he's cautiously optimistic Congress will put cotton back into Title I of the 2018 Farm Bill, especially since the House just included it in its recent disaster aid package. And economist John Robinson expects China to deplete its cotton reserves soon, creating new demand for cotton. So the cotton industry's push into athleisure wear comes at a time when farmers are hoping to stretch into a newly energized market. In Chapel Hill, North Carolina, I'm James Morrison for Marketplace.
Coming up?
New Year's Day was a day when you watched bowl games with your dad and ate potato chips and California dip.
Why are there 40 college football bowl games these days? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was off 118 points, 0.4%, to finish at 24,719. The Nasdaq lost 46 points, 0.6%, to close at 6903. And the S&P 500 shed 13 points, 0.5%, to end at 2673. For the week, the Dow dipped 0.1%. The Nasdaq fell 0.8%. And the S&P 500 moved down 0.3%. Tech faltered on the last trading day of the year. Amazon dropped 1.4%. Apple soured 1%. Digital video recording company TiVo leapt 11.4% after reports that private equity firms are interested in acquiring the company. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.40%. You're listening to Marketplace.
December 31st is coming up fast, and that means time is running out to make your tax-deductible donation to support Marketplace. We're all about making people smarter about the financial forces that govern our lives and raising economic intelligence in a big way. It's important work that we are already doing, and with your help, we'll be able to do even more of it. So now is the time. Go to Marketplace.org and make a gift in any amount to become a Marketplace investor today. And thanks.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. Cryptocurrencies. Are you still trying to get your head around them? So are foreign governments. Cryptocurrencies can be high value and volatile. To get a handle on them, South Korea, for one, wants tighter regulations. Sabri Benishore reports.
Cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin are on fire in Asia.
Over time, different countries become the epicenter of where trading is happening. And right now, that really has, in a way, become South Korea.
Jaron Lukasevich is a former founder of a trading exchange and an advisor on cryptocurrencies.
It's clear that there's manipulation happening in this market, right? So I think it was fairly inevitable that the government of South Korea would take an action.
South Korea will ban anonymous cryptocurrency accounts. It'll require people to pay taxes on their cryptocurrency earnings, like they do in the U.S., And major financial institutions wouldn't be allowed to play with digital currencies. That rule doesn't exist in the U.S. Globally, regulation of cryptocurrencies varies.
Well, it really is very fragmented.
Nick Colas is co-founder of Data Trek Research. In places like New York and soon South Korea, there are a lot of rules. In other places, not many at all, he says. One area he sees as ripe for more regulation, leverage, borrowing money to invest in cryptocurrency.
There are people taking out mortgages on their homes and using credit cards to buy cryptocurrencies, and that's where it gets really dangerous.
Gil Luria directs research at D.A. Davidson. He says regulations are still evolving.
So any certainty around regulation would be the best thing for a cryptocurrency. It is the uncertainty that is limiting the growth.
Regulation is clearly not killing cryptocurrencies. There are hundreds of them. And one Bitcoin, a currency you cannot touch or feel, that you cannot use to buy anything in most places, is still worth around $14,000. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
For a lot of folks, college football is a New Year's Day tradition. Curl up on the couch, take one last day to be lazy, relax your way through the end of the holidays. There will be 5 college bowl games this January 1st, 40 bowl games this year, including today's succinctly named Franklin American Mortgage Music City Bowl. In our latest installment of Holidays brought to you by Marketplace's Andy Euler explains how we got to all these bowl games.
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by
the 1985 Orange Bowl. It's brought to you by...
Remember that 1985 Orange Bowl game? New Year's Day, Oklahoma against Washington. No? Me neither. I was 3 at the time. But if you were watching, you might remember this Delta Airlines commercial. Long before goofy commercials and New Year's college football bowl games, in fact, on January 1st, 1902, the new president of the Tournament of Roses Parade had an idea. He decided Pasadena, California would stage a college football game to drum up tourism in the area. Other cities liked the idea and followed suit. Rob Bauman at College of the Holy Cross explains.
A lot of bowls were formed by local nonprofit tourism and commerce committees of cities so that they could promote the area and they could invite people from out of town, which were the teams and the staff and all the fans.
In fact, we didn't even call them bowl games until 1923, when the game first moved to Pasadena's famous Rose Bowl Stadium. In the 20s and 30s, these bowl games became popular on the radio with plenty of sponsors and commercials. But on New Year's Day in 1952, exactly 50 years after the first game of its kind, everything changed. The first Rose Bowl was televised nationally, and there was no going back.
New Year's Day was a day when you, watched bowl games with your dad and ate potato chips and California dip.
Michael Oriar there was the starting center for Notre Dame in the 1969 Cotton Bowl between the Fighting Irish and Texas Longhorns. He also wrote the book Bowled Over, Big Time College Football from the 60s to the BCS era.
When I grew up, there were 4 bowl games, the Orange, Sugar, Cotton, and Rose Bowl. And it was understood in the context of this struggle to keep college football in proper perspective.
Today, college football is a multi-billion-dollar business, and it's not just 4 games on New Year's Day. It's 40. They start December 16th and last into the second week of January. Since the 1980s, there's been one big reason for that.
I think you then saw the cable universe explode. It's very vast. They needed programming.
David Carter runs the University of Southern California's Sports Business Institute. He says one network in particular is hungry for content.
You have to look at the amount of bandwidth that ESPN has. They've got programming to fill.
ESPN and ABC will broadcast 35 of the 40 games this year, like the DXL Frisco Bowl, on a Wednesday night. I went to a Buffalo Wild Wings in Austin to see what kind of response the game was getting. It was on a couple TVs, but nobody was really watching. It wasn't a great game, but it was a bowl game nonetheless. So is college football serving up too many bowls? Wright Waters is executive director of the Football Bowl Association.
If you're coming from the position of, I want the bowls to be part of a championship, then yeah, But if you're coming from the position of opportunities for student athletes, I'm not sure that argument holds water.
Sure, the players get a swag bag and a few extra weeks of practice to show their talent off to NFL scouts, but they're still not getting paid. And Rob Bauman at College of the Holy Cross says the local communities aren't getting much out of these bowl games anymore either.
This does not support the local economy. And that picture is somewhat getting worse as the attention gets focused to national TV audiences as opposed to attendance in the seats.
It's a far cry from New Year's Day in 1902, when Pasadena officials just wanted folks to come out to their little village's floral festival, maybe watch a football game in passing. You can still watch the Rose Bowl on New Year's Day, but you're not going to know the final college football rankings until a week later on the night of January 8th. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
As you write your New Year's resolutions this year, eating less meat, more vegetables could be on your list. The vegetarian butcher in The Hague is trying to make it easier for carnivores to make the switch. The BBC's Anna Holligan has the story.
Inside the vegetarian butcher, the freezer shelves are being neatly stocked with products presented in red and white checked packaging. The walls are tiled, pristine white. It's designed to feel like an old-fashioned butcher shop.
Our ambition is to be the biggest butcher in the real world, but we are already the biggest butcher on Facebook and Twitter.
The co-founder of the vegetarian butcher, Nico Kaufman, believes this contradiction in terms whets the appetite of both vegetarians and carnivores.
The concept was to serve meat lovers with a meat-like product that couldn't be distinguished from real meat. We thought that this oxymoron could be itchy enough to make people think, what's in it for me? The ambition is always to have the product as good as the real meat product. If it's good enough to fool a meat eater, then it's good enough for us.
On current predictions, by 2050, there won't be enough food to feed the world's swelling population. Farm animals consume 8% of the world's water supply too, and they produce around 15% of unnatural greenhouse gas emissions. It could lead to environmental problems in the future.
Meat is not sustainable, it's not good for our health. Nobody likes the way we treat animals in factory farms. The only reason is the taste. People are hooked on the taste of meat.
Jaap Kortweg is the vegetarian butcher, a ninth-generation farmer who turned veggie after storing pig carcasses during the swine flu crisis. He struggled to find meat replacements he liked, and so created his own.
There are no principal meat eaters in the sense that they want animals to die for it. To men who say, if you are a real man, you must eat meat. Mike Tyson is a champion fighter. He's a vegan too, so I'd say to them, tell it to Mike Tyson in person.
We are, of course, talking to the converted here. So for a more objective view, we invited a carnivorous food critic.
Ready as I'll ever be.
Joel Brocart, out to dine on the veggie option.
So tell us what we are looking at here.
Well, we have a double cheeseburger, I would call it. There's two patties and a piece of molten cheese on top.
The most important part, the taste.
Okay, it does blend with the cheese and the onion and the pickle, with a little bit umami to it, like meat would have. So at first, it's very well camouflaged. I've tasted really bad hamburgers that were worse than this one.
Does it have the flavor of a hamburger, of a meat burger?
No, it's a very savory, meaty vegetable patty. That's what it is, but it's not meat.
For people who want food that looks and tastes as if it's come from farm animals, these products offer hope that you don't need to kill an animal to get that meaty experience.
That's the BBC's Anna Holligan reporting from The Hague. this final note before we go today, sticking with plant-based diets, Los Angeles is considering feeding shelter dogs vegan kibble. They've asked for a report on the pluses and minuses of the plan. On the plus side, it is better for the environment. In the minus column, the Washington Post reports the vegan food could cost as much as 4 times the current food. There's also worried about the digestive implications for the dogs and the folks who have to clean up after them. If LA shelters do go vegan, they say they'd be the first in the country, which maybe isn't surprising. Today, the Dow was off 118 points, 0.4%. The Nasdaq lost 46 points, 0.6%. And the S&P 500 shed 13 points, 0.5%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Adrienne Hill. Have a great weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.